being equal, that's a very nice goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are women and young girls who watch animation and like to see a representation of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They like to see that adventurous role model, or that smart role model, or that mm-hmm. silly role model on the screen. And I like the idea of getting those genuine characters by having authentic people behind it. And so to get an authentic female character by having an authentic female voice behind her.
The Ink and Paint Girls podcast, where we celebrate women working in animation, illustration, and comics. In an effort to share their stories, we not only cover the steps they have taken to get to their dream jobs, but also the struggles. We highlight artists, writers, and producers, explore the ups and downs of working in the industry, and discuss female representation behind the scenes and on the screen. Zabrina McIntyre is a production coordinator on the Tangled animated series over at Disney TV Animation. She got her start as a production secretary on Wander Over Yonder with a promotion to production associate soon after. Although this is how she got her professional start in animation, what happened before that? Well, there's a whole story before that where Zabrina worked at the Smithsonian Institute and left that lucrative career to get a graduate degree. You'll hear all of this and more right now.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for asking me to be on your show. I think it's really cool and flattering, so thank you. I am a production coordinator with Disney Television Animation right now, and I am from San Diego originally, but my journey to animation kind of took some time, and I've lived a lot of different places, but I have finally found my true career passion in animation, and I'm really enjoying it.
In saying that you finally found your career passion, that means you obviously had a different career at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is correct. My very first job out of college was I worked for the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. I organized and planned educational cultural programs, so like lectures, seminars, behind-the-scenes tours of the Smithsonian, that sort of thing, which was a really cool job. I liked it a lot. I did it for 4 years. And the reason why I got that job was I was an art history major in undergrad. And, of course, what does an art history major do but they go work in a museum? So that's what really made sense at the time, because I've always loved art. And art history was my access to art, because I've never been artistic myself. Mm-hmm. I really wish I could, but I'm just not one of the people who's going to be able to make traditional art that I'm happy with, at least. But I'm very happy appreciating and supporting others' art
mm-hmm.
of a visual sense.
Yeah, but you're very creative, even though you're not artistic in, like, the drawing kind of way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think creativity is kind of a larger scope of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been crafty and just appreciate the arts and writing. So all of those aspects.
When you were, like, a kid, were you, like, really into animation at all? Or was it just, like, broad strokes art?
Oh, no. I loved animation. Loved animation. I would watch animation growing up, like all of the Disney movies. My parents were really supportive, and that was always playing. We had those like clamshell collection of them. And then even as I got older, I would watch kind of like the edgier high school series. So I had Gargoyles and X-Men the animated series, Batman the animated series.
Mm-hmm.
Loved Batman the animated series. So I'd say I grew up with animation.
So when you were at the Smithsonian, you started getting tasked with art prints in the museum gift shop.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how that kind of led you into this new area?
part of the Smithsonian Associates, which was the division of the Smithsonian I worked for, sold fine art prints, so serigraphs, that were a fundraising initiative that the artists would donate the original print and the Smithsonian would reproduce it and then sell it, and those proceeds would go to help support the Smithsonian initiatives. Mm-hmm. Well, with various reorganizations, it sort of fell into my lap because in this office, I was the most qualified with an art history background. So I was doing the special events type work, but at the same time, I was also selling the art prints. And I didn't feel like I was as qualified to do it as I wanted to be. So I sought out an art gallery, and it was because what I was interested in, an animation and film art gallery, Art Insights in Reston, Virginia, just outside D.C., and I asked them to take me on as an intern. So I kept my full-time Smithsonian job, but I was also interning at this art gallery because I wanted to better learn how to do this other aspect of my job, which was selling and handling and promoting artwork. And that was super cool. So I really enjoyed it, and I'm still friends with the owner and just had a great time. And it was really fun to see that aspect of selling the artwork, but then also the art gallery showed me of animation as art and movie posters. They sold the original artwork for movie posters. So that helped expand just my knowledge and awareness of animation in that way as well.
What I love about, like, this portion of your story is that, like, you sought out the opportunity to learn more, and I know you didn't say that here, but you convinced the gallery that they needed an intern and what you could do as an intern, and I think that's amazing. You know, like, instead of the place going, we don't need someone, we don't need an intern, you had reasons. Can you, like, talk about, like, how you got so gutsy?
Gutsy, that's flattering. I don't know. I was approaching them. It was a cold approach, and I had already visited the gallery to kind of interview them in a way, just to make sure that they were a place that I wanted to work, because what I was offering was my time. Like, I wanted to learn some things, but I was also offering my time. And in order to convince them that I was serious, I wanted to offer them a set amount of time. So I was initially committing to 6 months, and I was keeping my full-time job. So this would have been on the weekends. So for a while, I was going to work 6 days a week, basically. And I went in, like I said, I already sort of scoped them out. So knew I wanted to work for them. And I went in, you know, I looked professional, I had my resume, and I treated it like I was going for a job interview. And I just asked, and like, I'm very interested in being your intern. I wonder if you would consider it. And I had a lot of very good reasons. And I even had my Smithsonian ID with me, because I sort of, as I was doing it, felt like a crazy person, you know, like, here I'm just walking in off the street. I'm like, no, really, I have a Smithsonian ID. I've been federally background checked. Like, so at least you can trust that.
Yeah.
And she was great. She was like, okay, well, that's very interesting. And she said that they had had interns in the past and they hadn't quite worked out. So she needed to think about it and talk about it with her business partner and let me know. And she took my resume and did decide to give me a chance. And I had initially committed to 6 months of up to three Saturdays a month. And then we would go from there. And I ended up working with the gallery for about a year.
Wow. So it worked out pretty well, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I'm still friends with the gallery owner. So it was a really positive experience. And through that, I gained the confidence and awareness that I was looking for to help me better represent the Smithsonian's art prints and just kind of the basics of how to interact with clients in that way. Cause I'd never actually had a retail background before. And those are just different skills.
I feel like selling art is a different skill than, you know, selling books or something too.
It's a very passion based thing. It's a very passion based activity because this is art. It's something that people have strong reactions to. It's not a need per se, like a book or a coat or even a car in a way. It's something that it's going to decorate your world. So people have to love it.
So from your year working there, you probably learned like a lot of like animation terms and just about animation more so in like as a craft, right? Like, did they talk about how, like, the art was made so you could communicate that with the clients and stuff?
Yeah, definitely. Because, like I said, growing up, I always watched animation and loved it from that aspect, but I really had no concept for what went into the creation of it. And that's why it took me so long to find it as a career, because I thought if you want to work in animation, you're an animator, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, and I'm sure a lot of people's minds still, it's an animator does the drawings and maybe it goes to ink and paint and then that's it. I didn't know about the storyboarding process of board artists, of layout drawings, of prop designers. I didn't know all of those smaller pieces that make up the whole. Mm-hmm. So at the gallery, I was able to see the difference and learn the difference between an animated cell versus a key setup that pairs it with the background versus a developmental sketch that might not appear in the final piece, but is certainly an important part of the process.
Mm. Is that where you got your pieces of art in your house?
Yes. Some of it. Yes. I do have a lot of animation art in my apartment because I like surrounding myself with it, and that's part of me treating animation as art is treating it as art in my home.
Very cool. So once this year wrapped up, you decided to go get a master's.
Yes, I moved to London because why not? I had been looking at it and wanting that next step in my career from the Smithsonian, and really in the museum world, if you want to advance into a higher position, leadership position, you need an advanced degree, like master's minimum in order to be a director. Like everyone has PhDs. It's just, those are just the requirements of that world. So I thought, okay, well, I should go get a master's degree then if this is the career path that I want to stay and have the opportunity to advance in. Is the Smithsonian is a nonprofit institution and the economy had crashed then. So nobody had money. There was no money to do anything. There were a lot of layoffs. And the big lesson I learned is even if you are a nonprofit, you still need to know the basics of business and how to financially support yourself and to raise funds. Whether you do it with donors or selling tickets to lectures and seminars like we were doing, you still need to know those kind of financial basics. So I decided to earn my master's in art business because I got the business degree aspect. So management, marketing, finance, with, you know, making it more appealing to me personally. So it wasn't just dry cut finance classes. It was finance, but with that art context. So making me actually care. And I found this program with Sotheby's Institute of Art of a Masters of Art in Art Business, and it was in London. And so if I was going to go earn my master's degree, why not go to London to do it?
Definitely.
yeah, so after 4 years at the Smithsonian and also the last year working at the art gallery, packed up everything, sold my car, and moved to London.
That's crazy.
It kind of was.
It doesn't matter what people say, but were there some, naysayers in that moment of your life when you made this huge decision?
Actually, there weren't. And I'm kind of surprised, where were the people telling me I was crazy? And, why are you doing this? Because I was leaving a good job where I was appreciated and there was still room for growth. And just sort of giving up everything to move to another country to earn my master's degree that I honestly didn't know what I was going to do with once I got it. Mm. So even looking back now, I'm like, gosh, I did that. And I think a lot of people were just so, wow, okay, you're going to London. Isn't that so cool? That kind of the glamour aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And also, if anyone had been a naysayer, I wouldn't have listened to anyone.
Yeah, which is good.
Yeah. That's the truth too. I mean, I've been back to visit several times actually already. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of good friends who still live in London, and London is my favorite city in the world.
That's so cool.
And now whether I'd go back to live, anything's possible. And I am in a doctorate program, and my doctorate school is Middlesex University in London, so I am still connected to London. Mm. Part of my doctorate initiative was finding a way to stay in London, so that's why my school is in London versus some other place, because I wanted to stay in London, and that was another way to do it, mm-hmm. while also pursuing this degree that I was interested in doing. It was, again, one of those combinations of, well, if I want to live here and I want to do this, then that just makes sense to do it in the same place.
Since you are getting a doctorate, I don't know if this question is kind of null, but if you were to do it all over again with the master's degree, would you?
That's one of those tricky questions, and I'm more of a forward future thinker. I don't really go back and dwell on, well, would I do it differently? Because I'm like, no, I'm happy with where I ended up, so it all worked out. Mm-hmm. And earning my master's degree, even if it's not always relevant, it's something I'll always have. So that's kind of cool.
How does it feel to work in an industry that doesn't care if you have a master's degree? Because that's coming up really soon.
Yeah, that was a little interesting to come from the Smithsonian, like I said, where everybody has an advanced degree in leadership positions, and if you want to advance, to an industry where it's really talent-based. It's talent and hard work. So there's some of my coworkers who never even finished an undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't matter. And that's fine. I'm not saying it should matter. But it's also when I am looking at future prospects, I'm like, well, I do have a master's degree. They're like, okay, that, nice for you.
I feel like it would maybe make a difference if you're, independent producing, you know? Because then you really do have that need to have that business acumen, in fundraising and everything. But maybe in the studio system, it's, not a big deal.
Well, there's still a lot of potential for it to be relevant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a requirement, but some experience or awareness with finance and budgets and the great Excel spreadsheets, those sort of things that you cover in a business master's degree, people use those skills.
And you're currently using those skills at Disney on Tangled, the TV series?
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm a production coordinator on that show, which is set to premiere, I think, February of 2017. So it hasn't aired yet, so I can't really talk much about it. But we are hard at work making it. Yeah. I'm really excited about that.
And it looks really good. Before we go any further, so how did you get from London, master's degree, visa stuff, all the way to L.A.?
Yeah, because that wasn't exactly a very obvious path either. So I earned this master's degree, and that's one of the funny things of if the stars had aligned in a different way, I'd be living in London as a corporate art consultant.
Oh.
Because that's what I was pursuing. That's what I was pursuing at the time with one of my classmates, and the visa didn't work out. But so my master's degree, the end of it, I had to write a dissertation, and I had the option of choosing whatever topic I was interested in. My program was art business, Sotheby's Institute of Art. It had a close tie with the auction house, Sotheby's. So a lot of my classmates were looking at the auction market, the art market calendar, the sale of diamonds, the art speculation market, that sort of thing. And at the time, I really wasn't interested in that. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as interested in working for the auction house aspect. So my advisor said to me, well, what are you interested in? I said, well, I like animation. And that had kind of came about. I was aware of animation tangentially related to auctions because in the 90s, Sotheby's hosted animation art auctions. Mm-hmm. They sold the original backgrounds to The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King. And these auctions, again, early 90s, netted over $1 million.
Wow.
So that wasn't a small thing. So as I'm sort of thinking about animation and the auctions and Sotheby's selling it, like they do fine art, and mm-hmm. I was, of course, drawing upon my background of the museum world, I thought, why don't I research animation within a museum context? That would bridge my passion of animation and my background of museum work. So that's what I did, and I loved it. It was so much fun. I got to spend 3 months researching museum exhibitions and museums and animation and the theme of animation as art, of what are the contexts, what are the examples of animation being framed, hung on the wall, and having people look at it in a different venue than as a film. Because when you pull single images, that really forces somebody to look at it. Mm-hmm. So you're not just looking at the whole piece, which is certainly beautiful in its own right, and that's what you have film studies with. Mm-hmm. But with animation, it's interesting because when you pull each individual frame, that's somebody's work. That's somebody's art as well in every frame.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to spend 3 months researching it, and I loved it. And that dissertation is really what exposed me to the other career possibilities in animation. Because the people I was interviewing, actually, they weren't animators. They were a lot of the people around animation. So there were the museum people, so curators, museum directors.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were also the people who worked at Disney's Animation Research Library,
mm-hmm.
whose job was to work with animation, but not in an animation context. And that's also where I learned about production, of the people behind the scenes keeping the art moving through the pipeline. I was like, well, that's interesting. So I liked learning about that. And that was in the back of my mind, and I had so much fun researching that I wanted to continue. So that's the topic of my doctorate work. I wanted to continue that and explore that more thoroughly. So when I couldn't stay in London and I was looking for other opportunities, I'm like, well, I'm going to go earn my doctorate and then stay in London that way. That'll be really cool. And then I did get into a doctorate program. Like I said, I still am, because I find that fascinating. But I needed a job, because by this point I hadn't been working for over 2 years, and I started looking at possibilities, and I wasn't as excited about going back into the museum world, even though I could, and I even could have returned to the Smithsonian. They kindly offered me my job back, but I decided that I wanted to go forward in a different direction. So I decided I am going to restart my career and I am going to work in the animation industry. I have no talent. I am not an animator, but I'm going to be one of those production people who gets things done and helps support the animation artwork through the process.
I have to ask. So I'm sure, being like the animation history buff that you are, you know that back in the early days when they were just starting to like figure out their pipelines for making animated films, particularly I'm thinking of Disney, at the end of production, they would take all of their animation drawings, in-betweens, roughs, cleanups, and they would burn it. And from what I hear, it was like a bin behind the studio or something like that. I don't know. But all of this stuff just burning. All of the stuff you want to, like, save and share with the world and talk about and research, all burning. How do you feel about that?
Can you see me cringe?
Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's different. When you have 24 frames per second, you will end up with a lot of drawings, a lot of cells that go into a 90-minute feature. So there is some aspect that some things are a little bit more disposable than others. I suppose when you have images where a character is blinking, people are not as interested in those moments where the eyes are closed versus open. So, but still, the person, I don't like the idea of anything being destroyed like yeah, that. Totally. It just sounds awful. So even though you could make the argument of, well, you can't save everything and be more discerning and selective, sure, you know, that those are the things that are hung on the museum wall, but I don't like the idea of anything being destroyed, because it still has value for the animators, for the researchers, for historical purposes.
I think I would have saved animation drawings, like the roughs.
Yeah.
And the ink and paint.
Yeah.
So those would be my first two.
I mean, it's not just burning. That stuff takes up room. So there's that practicality of it, of if you are business-minded and can't save everything, you have to get rid of stuff. Mm-hmm. Also, I know with the cells themselves, that had value, so they'd use it, scrape the paint off.
That's true.
So they could reuse it. And that was a cost-saving measure, because when your end goal is to produce the film, those sorts of things, that just helps you be cost-effective so that you can produce the film without going bankrupt. So stories like making drawings on both sides of the paper, so you maximize the paper. Background pieces. There's some backgrounds that were done on glass plates, right? Especially with the multi-plane camera, that you have the glass elements. So once they filmed that, you know, you just clear off the glass, because that's expensive, and then you just repaint it. So I don't think people were dancing around a bonfire with glee.
Yeah.
I mean, I do understand that there was a purpose to it sometimes, too.
Definitely. I have to say, I went to the Animation Research Library once, and I got to see...
We were on that tour together.
Oh, we were! Yeah!
That's where we met!
Oh my god, it's true!
You're hanging out in the lobby, and I'm like, hi!
I forgot that's where we met. I just felt like we just met, and that was it. And that was it. Okay, that makes sense. But... So you remember when he was showing us, like, the long piece of glass? It was like a pan of Once Upon a Wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
That was my favorite. I cried a little. I teared up. It was amazing.
It's so beautiful. And now the Animation Research Library is just so sophisticated and respectful with how they treat these pieces that it is kind of funny to think of way back in the day when they weren't treated like that, but at least they are being preserved now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing what they have there. And to see all those boxes open with, like, these, like, rough Fred Moore sketches from Fantasia.
Oh my gosh,
the pastoral scene.
I love the Mary Blair concept that they have.
Totally.
That's gorgeous.
Mm. Yeah. So, you just declared, I'm going to work in animation. I'm going to move to LA. No one else is doing this. I'm going to make it. No problem. So, what next? What happens when you get to LA?
There was actually an in-between step where I lived in New York City for a few months.
Fancy.
So, I didn't move direct from London to LA. I moved to New York for family reasons. So, I'm in New York, which is a new city for me, and I've declared I'm going to work in animation.
Yeah.
I am pursuing my doctorate as a distance learner at that point. So, you know, I have my resume with all my Smithsonian experience and my newly minted master's degree and my doctorate, you know, as like the little footnote of, you know, animation. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to work in animation. Well, it took a while for me to meet people and to really break into the industry and to convince people that I was serious about making this career change.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't go to Cal Arts. I didn't have a obvious animation kind of path. I had other skills sort of on my resume. So I was talking to everyone I could. I joined Women in Animation. I just dived right in and went to all of their events, talked to everyone, and told them about my history and what I wanted to do. I'm like, I want to be in production. I will take all of your wisdom. Whatever advice you have, I want to hear it. So I just talked to everyone I could, and people would recommend me to other people, and I would follow up on all of those leads.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to a lot of people, learning more about the animation industry, about specific jobs that are available, so production coordinator versus script coordinator versus, you know, producer, like what those different kind of jobs entail. So I was learning a lot there and also getting leads of, I was able to go to Nickelodeon and speak to somebody actually in the studio. Women in Animation had tours organized, so I went on those and was able to see like Frederator in New York. So just, I was really trying to absorb it, and I was trying to really listen to the advice. Not just talking to people, but really listening. Because when you talk to enough people and you have different people saying the same thing, the same types of things, then you're like, aha, that's maybe something to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Because the thing with advice, you don't have to universally accept all of it. And in fact, you shouldn't. But when multiple different people are trying to tell you things, and actually one of the pieces was, if you really want to break into the animation industry, try LA.
Mm.
Because for someone like me that wasn't coming from a studio already, I didn't have animation experience looking for an animation job, I was getting the feedback that it's not impossible in New York. just the fact that there are more opportunities in LA, that there's more studios, more job opportunities. I probably would have better luck at breaking in. So I'm like, okay. So for family reasons, I ended up moving back to California. My parents are from San Diego. So it just sort of worked out that at the same time, like, well, people are telling me to move to LA. I can. Let's just go for it. Mm-hmm. See what happens. So I came back to California, and this had been almost a year of trying to break into the animation industry. So then by the time I got to LA, everything had really aligned that within, I guess, 2 weeks of me moving to California, I had an informal interview, like just like a coffee interview. And a week after that, I had an actual job interview. And then a week after that, I was working. And
what?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So that was really cool that once I made that move, all of the legwork I had done in New York helped, because the person I had that coffee interview with, who introduced me to who was going to be my boss, I had met, I think I traced it back 9 degrees back of, I talked to that person because so-and-so said, so-and-so said. So if I traced it all the way back, it was like 9 links that led me to that person at that place that, you know, I didn't give up. Mm-hmm. I like to say I was pleasantly persistent, mm-hmm. that it's keeping that positive attitude and continuing to move forward, but being persistent at it, because mm-hmm. it took me a year and way more than 9 different informational interviews, but I ended up exactly where I wanted to be.
That's an inspiring story. Were there any times when you felt like giving up during that 1 year?
I mean, it was difficult for other reasons. The economic landscape, though, for a lot of people was just really challenging. So I didn't feel like it was just me having a hard time, which helped. And I didn't have any problems getting people to talk to me. And of course, I was sending out resumes and everything, and I had job interviews. But the job interviews I had, you know, it didn't quite feel right. So even though I was getting interviews, I was looking for that good fit. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want just a job. I knew I wanted a career job.
Mm-hmm. So during these interviews in New York, were you also interviewing them like you're so good at doing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because if I'm interviewing, yes, I'm selling myself, but I'm also mm-hmm. trying to figure out if I want to buy them, you know,
yeah.
in that sort of weird way, because I don't want to work with somebody who just doesn't even conduct a professional interview, or who I got, because unfortunately in New York, I did get some borderline discriminatory kind of interview questions. Mm-hmm. And for people who are crossing the line, or at least feeling questionable in an interview, that's not really what I want in a work environment. Because mm-hmm. in the interview, we both should be putting our best foot forward. And if the person who is interviewing me is late, that's totally their prerogative to be mm-hmm. late. I can't be late as the interviewee, but it also is like, I wonder how they manage their time.
Yeah.
So, you know, just stuff like that.
Wow. How did you handle the discriminatory interview questions or things that happened?
I stayed professional in the interview, but then as soon as I left, it was like, nope, that's not going back there. And of course, I'd vent to family and friends about, like, can you believe this?
Yeah.
And
back to LA.
Okay, yes.
So, in this job was with Disney TV.
Yes.
That's crazy. Usually it takes people a lot longer to get to Disney.
Yeah, that... I never started out thinking I'm going to work for Disney. My goal was I wanted a job in animation. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find the best fit for me in animation that I felt good and had career opportunities. And it just so happened that Disney Television Animation was the place that gave me my opportunity. Because again, like I said, my resume on the surface doesn't look so much like a girl who wants to be in animation. But I was able to convince the person that, like, no, I am serious. I'm a WIA member. I'm an ASIFA member. I'm doing all of these things. I've been working for the last year. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And she gave me the opportunity. And it was on Wander Over Yonder, which is a show that I love so much and was such a great first experience show for me. That I just feel really grateful that I had that opportunity and that I have that foundation for my animation career.
And you started as a production secretary, right?
Yes. So that's the thing about starting over with a second career is you have to be willing to start from the bottom again. And that is challenging because, you know, pay scales are reflected accordingly. I took a huge pay cut from what I had been earning at the Smithsonian before my master's degree. But that's kind of how it goes. If I was serious about wanting to get my foot in the door and wanting that new career, I had to be willing to start at the bottom. So I did. And I started as the production secretary. And it's not like that's the bottom, like it's a bad thing. That's a very good position to get an overview of the process and the company and to meet a lot of people. So I had a great time and I was promoted after 4 months to production, you know, assistant associate. And I was in that position for about a year, and then I switched shows to Tangled, and so now I'm production coordinator. So all of my experience and job experience and my education, you know, that does contribute to why I was promoted so quickly. This isn't my first job. This isn't the first time I've been in a professional environment. I do have those basic transferable skills. I'm just now applying them to the animation field, and I would like to be a producer one day. So there is that nice career path, and I am ambitious in a lot of things, so I want to see how far I can go.
You're on a great upward path.
Sure.
Next, we'll talk about your steps to getting to producer, because you're really great with, like, picking a goal and then taking it back to follow those steps to get to that goal. I feel like that's your entire story, right? You keep picking a new goal and going after it.
Yeah.
So you want to be a producer. Do you want to stay in TV animation?
I'm very happy there right now. Yeah, I don't have a preference of TV animation versus feature animation.
You just love animation.
I just love animation. That's right. TV, I get IMDb credits faster.
That's so true.
I learned that. And with a healthy IMDb profile, it qualifies me for professional status at Comic-Con.
Oh, very nice.
So, it has its perks.
What are your steps to getting to that producer level?
Really, just sticking with it, and I'm realistic and know that you don't achieve a goal like that in a year or the next day. It's the type of thing that's a career type of goal progression. So right now, it's focusing on doing my current job to the best of my ability, to having a comprehension of what my immediate next step would be, and also what a producer actually does, because if I understand that role, then I can understand better what skills I might need or want to sort of expand in order to get to that level. So it's a long-term goal, and it's the feeling of being comfortable and being patient that I like having goals. It's out there. I'll get there.
Yeah.
There are steps that I need to take before I get there. And also organizations like WIA, Women in Animation, of building that professional network, because part of taking that next career step is having the opportunities. So it's knowing more people and having people know your goals as well, so that as new opportunities come up, you're in a position to take advantage of it, or they know and can think of you.
Mm-hmm.
Also, WIA right now is doing a mentorship kind of initiative, and that's really good for career progression. I think everyone should have a career mentor. And there's different ways you can have a career mentor. Mm-hmm. You can have somebody who is actually your mentor in a structured, we're going to be mentors sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one way. There's also another way that you pick a person and basically be their unofficial mentee of just talking to them, learning about their career progression, seeing how they do things. There's even aspirational career mentors that you don't even have to know personally, but admire their career path and having an understanding of what they've done in their career that might have led them to the role that they currently are in or that you want to get to as well.
So in being very active with WIA, you're also very active. Is it yearly? Is it a yearly expo?
Oh, the Animation Summit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a yearly summit. This will be its fifth year now. So it's still fairly young, but it's growing. And this will be my third year as the Director of Volunteers. So in that role, I recruit, interview, schedule, and do on-site management for all of their volunteer staff. So last year, that was about 50 people. And so the different scheduling and the roles and the World Animation and Visual Effects Summit, those skills are my combination of animation, my animation interest, because that is the topic of the summit, but also my events experience from the Smithsonian of how to organize people traffic flow and logistics for an event and where to place people to be the most helpful as people are coming and going from a room. So the summit was actually a way that I used to help bridge into animation. I have these skills, I can put them to use in this context and get some more animation related experience and contacts. So, and I really like that role because I get to meet so many people, and even the people that I interview and recruit, a lot of them are students who want to be in the animation industry, and so it's also giving them that experience of you're in this professional environment and learning those skills, but also getting that animation exposure.
You're really into the whole animation community thing. Like, I know when I first met you, that's, like, I got that feeling. Like,
yeah.
You're just really into the community of it. Which is really refreshing because a lot of the people that I've encountered, they just kind of show up to work, do their thing, and go home, you know?
Yeah,
or they want to keep drawing at their desk at home after drawing all day. So I think that's really, really amazing because there are some, like, really great people in the industry and, you know, pre-professionals who are trying to get in. And I think it's, I mean, you come together to make these shows and these movies, like, it's a group effort, it's a collaboration.
It
so,
really
like,
is.
You know, being a part of the community just feels like it's just a bigger view of that, you know? Like, what are your personal feelings or philosophies about how active you are in, like, outside organizations?
Well, I really love this community, and it is a community. So, having worked in other industries, I know that there's a difference. And part of it is because it's show-based. People come together, they create a show, that show is completed, and then people disperse and go on to create other things. And that kind of gathering, coming together, and dispersing just creates this network of everyone knows everyone else, or is, you know, only a few degrees of separation because, oh, you, I worked with so-and-so way back on this other project. Mm-hmm. And that does create a community, and also people who have an awareness and need to have an awareness, because we're basically always looking for jobs, which is scary on one level. And that was something I had to personally come to terms with in joining the animation career with my eyes wide open of, I will probably always need to be looking and aware for a job. It's not like the Smithsonian where that museum's not going anywhere. Yeah. I could have worked in that job probably until I died.
Does that kind of freak you out? You pretty much your life is figured out for you?
It kind of did. And that's in a way what felt a little stale about it. But a lot of people love that type of security. And that's very comforting. And if you use that career security, you know, maybe to then be more adventurous in other aspects of your life, but like always feeling like you have a job, there's certainly benefits to that. But with the animation community, it's stressful. It's hard. It's uncertain. Mm-hmm. But it also has so many rewards as well.
I was going to say that. So last year, because I had a year-long contract at Disney.
Yeah.
And pretty much the entire time I was kind of freaking out about what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
And come to find out after, like, speaking with someone I recently met, they're like, that's a long time. Like, typically they last, like, six months. Like, you know, these, like, working on shows and stuff. And for artists, it can sometimes be even shorter.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing about production I like, is that, you know, you're hired pretty much first and then, like, let go last.
Yeah.
So I'm still struggling with this whole concept, but I'm glad you've come to terms that we will always be looking for work.
Well, it really freaks me out, and that does kind of bring me back to my involvement in the community.
Uh-huh.
Again, it took me a year to break into the community, mm-hmm. and I'm terrified now of being without a job. So it's that philosophy of maintaining your networks even when you don't need something, mm-hmm. and that's a networking philosophy of people don't really like the person who only talks to you when they need something. That's just a human nature of like, oh, you know, so-and-so only calls when she needs something.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that person. It doesn't really feel genuine,
mm-hmm.
but if you're out there talking to people and trying to help other people as well, it just feels like good karma.
Definitely. I've definitely been on, like, the end of that where I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to reach out to someone, and I realize that I haven't talked to them since, like, a few years ago.
Yeah.
And then I feel so guilty that I didn't keep up with it. But I end up not reaching out because it feels icky. Like, and I think a lot of people can relate to that icky feeling, no matter, like, whether it's reaching out just for, like, kind of just to introduce yourself to kind of meet someone,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's like reconnecting with someone you haven't seen in a while.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned WIA, Women in Animation, quite a few times, and their mission is to get more women in higher creative roles in animation.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there are more women in animation than ever before, but the numbers are actually still pretty low. I know I'm often the only female in a room still sometimes.
Yes. As am I.
Isn't that crazy?
I know.
Like, how do you, cause you've been around, you've seen some things since you're in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's your perspective on, women in animation currently?
Well, I like the idea of equality, and that doesn't seem like unreasonable goal or ideal of equality. And I think sometimes that can be lost in people misinterpreting promoting women as, oh, they want more women than men. It's like, well, but why can't we be equal? You know, like, sure, if there's more women than men, okay, but just being equal, that's a very nice goal,
mm-hmm.
because there are women and young girls who watch animation and like to see a representation of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They like to see that adventurous role model, or that smart role model, or that
mm-hmm.
silly role model on the screen. And I like the idea of getting those genuine characters by having authentic people behind it. And so to get an authentic female character by having an authentic female voice behind her. But also, if a woman wants to create a male character, that's not any more absurd than men controlling female characters on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So go for that too. But at least having that equal opportunity. Not quite women in animation, but just gender in media.
Mm-hmm.
Gina Davis, the actress, is very involved and has the Gina Davis Institute on
Gender Research.
Yes. I don't remember the exact title, but her initiative is basically equality for women as well,
mm-hmm.
with the idea of if you can see it, you can be it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds great. Like,
yeah.
We should do that.
Yeah.
The work they're doing is really great. There's been so much stuff being brought out of, like, just live-action film about, like, female directors and writers and stuff. I think it was a study, like, 2 years ago or something where there's, I think it was 13, don't take this as a quote, but I think it was, like, 13% of screenwriters, like, in TV
mm-hmm.
are women,
mm-hmm.
which is really sad. And, you know, and the more gender specific you get in terms of like, and then you get into LGBTQ+ and the numbers get even lower. After hearing all of this about your journey, what would you tell someone who wants to get into animation?
Well, the advice and sort of tagline I like to give is being pleasantly persistent of if you want to get an animation, then do it. Then believe in yourself and don't get discouraged if it doesn't happen immediately. Just know that if that's what you want to do, you might have to do other things to get there. But keeping sight of your goal is what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And being pleasantly persistent is letting people know that you have this goal. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Or to talk about how you're going about trying to achieve the goal, because maybe opportunities will come about from a direction that you're not expecting. And so that's why it does help to be open and to talk to anybody who's willing to speak with you and really listening to them. That's the thing that I know I had mentioned earlier of
mm-hmm.
if you're going to talk to somebody, really listen to what they're trying to say.
That's really good advice. So everyone should know about your side project. And really, it's not a side project. You've had this going for a while, right? With Animation Advocate?
Yeah. Animation Advocate, I started this kind of Twitter handle, Instagram thing, just as an outlet for what was some of my research that wasn't truly academic, but fun stuff I was discovering for the animation community that I was finding and wanted to share with people. And also when I eventually do really start writing animation books, I wanted to already have a platform to promote them, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. You're building your audience now, your platform.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to build the brand of me as Animation Advocate now, because
yeah.
That's part of my business degree in the works, is
mm-hmm.
personal branding and how to stand out among the crowd. And so that's what Animation Advocate is for me. You know, I only have a few followers, but I'm fine with that because I at least have that base. I have that body of work, even though it's, you know, tweets and Instagram photos and stuff, it still represents something that when I go to truly promote a book, then I have that base, and I'm not trying to both use social media and learning social media at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fun. It's fun to do. And I was having so much fun as Animation Advocate, and I found that I was posting so many photos from my trip to Disneyland that I started another Instagram account called All the Disneylands, which is just, it's, you know, just purely for fun to connect with the Disneyland community and to be able to post those photos. Because one of my many, many goals is to visit all of the Disneylands in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so far I've gone to, you know, Disneyland in Anaheim, also Disney World in Florida, Disneyland in Paris. That was very fun. And also just this last year, Tokyo Disney. And there's the two parks in Tokyo. So with all of those pictures, I wanted to share them.
Very nice. So if you're listening and you're a fan of Disneyland or Disney, definitely check that out on Instagram.
Exactly. All the Disneylands is for Disney photos, and then Animation Advocate covers all animation. It's not Disney exclusive.
Yeah. And with you researching, it's probably not things that you find so easily on the web.
Yeah, it does have more of a animation and museum focus at times. So as Laika was promoting Kubo and the Two Strings, they had two exhibitions that helped promote it. And so I went to those exhibitions, one of which was a free pop-up exhibition at the Japanese American National Museum here in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that necessarily would have been as obvious, but I like to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Pixar exhibition that's coming to the Science Museum in October of, I know where that exhibition has already been. I know it's coming. I know, you know, what's going to be there. And
uh-huh.
So it's kind of posting those photos as well to get people excited about seeing animation in these alternative contexts.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what has been exhibited more? Like, because it seems like there's a lot of animation exhibits happening, and especially the last decade. I'm trying to think of an artist to be like, which one has had more animation as a whole, or like Picasso, but Picasso's always on display, so maybe not that one.
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer.
Yeah.
Part of my research has just been trying to track, has animation been growing in exposure of exhibitions? And it really feels like it has. But I also look at the way animation is exhibited versus Picasso. You don't really go to a Picasso exhibit and learn how he painted, like, that first there was the canvas and then he primed it. And then, you know, you don't really get those steps within a Picasso exhibit, but a lot of the major animation exhibitions do show you the process and try to break it down for you. And I think that goes to the heart that a lot of people not in the industry still don't understand how it's created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you were talking, it just kind of hit me also that, you know, when you see a frame from like a movie you grew up watching, like you're also bringing something to it. You know, you're an emotional state you're bringing to it, or like your memories.
Yes. Yeah, animation is very emotional and memory based because that is one of those art forms a lot of us are exposed to as children, that they'll watch Cinderella. You know, it used to be on VHS, but now Cinderella on Blu-ray again and again. And then when they see it years later, it sparks that memory and that response that a Picasso probably wouldn't to a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
You know? A 5-year-old could go to see Picasso and enjoy it in the moment, but it's different in the way that it sticks with somebody just because those are different mediums.
Mm-hmm. What is your earliest memory that's triggered by animation?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably watching Bambi at my grandparents' house, because I would go over to my mom's parents and they had a larger collection than I think even my parents of the Disney classic movies on VHS. And when I went over to my grandparents' house, you know, I didn't have as many toys or other things to do, so we'd watch the movies. And they must have really liked Bambi, because it seems like that was the one that they put on. But I also remember having a strong emotional response to it, because that was almost my first exposure to bad things can happen.
Oh, yeah.
With, oh, why is Bambi's mother not there anymore?
Yeah.
So, and, you know, those are kind of the memories that are powerful.
I always expected the mom to come back when I was little. So I'm like, where'd she go? Are they just going to leave her?
Yeah.
You know, but never happened. That is one of the most sweetest and beautiful Disney movies, I think. And it's just so, like, evenly paced, too, you
mm-hmm.
know? It's a really amazing pacing that's unlike any of the other movies.
Yeah. So beautiful.
So you mentioned writing books. That's, like, a branch off of Animation Advocate.
Yes.
And you're currently working on something, right?
Yes. I am working on writing the companion book to a new documentary focusing on the UPA Animation Studio and its place in animation history. So I'm really excited for that. I'm writing the book in conjunction with the production of the documentary so that they can both complement each other, but also stand independently.
Oh, that's great.
So that's our goal, because so much research has been done for the documentary that it can't all fit in to
mm-hmm.
the documentary. So it's finding ways that this research can still have a home and a relevance and a way to be shared, but also making sense for the book individually and the documentary individually. So that website is The Boing Heard Round the World.
Great.
And, yes. So I'm involved in that project, and that's going to be really exciting once it comes out.
Hmm. Definitely. That's such an interesting era, too. I know it influences a lot of more design-y shows these days.
Yes.
Like, it's still very influential is what I'm saying.
Yeah, definitely. When people talk about UPA, a sort of recognition shows in their face as
mm-hmm.
they're thinking about its influence and how it perhaps influenced them personally and that own unique style that got
mm-hmm.
this response.
Yeah, because it was like shows like Gerald McBoing Boing,
yeah.
which is referencing
the, boing.
And what other things?
Well, Mr. Magoo.
Oh, yeah.
He's probably the most famous of UPA's characters. And Mr. Magoo's Christmas special, that was the first Christmas special. It's
oh,
often
wow.
overlooked now from, you know, Charlie Brown and the Grinch. But Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Magoo got there first.
So that's amazing. That's
yeah.
so cool. And you got that opportunity through the society for your PhD stuff?
That was actually another cold approach.
Oh! You're so amazing. Like,
this is
oh
part
my gosh.
Of putting yourself out there. T. Basisto, who I'm working with, he's the son of Stephen Basisto, who was one of the co-founders of the studio and is
what?
Organizing and leading the production of the documentary, had a table downtown Burbank for CTN's road trip
mm-hmm.
3 years ago now,
mm-hmm.
I guess time flies. And I was talking to everybody, and we got to talking, and I was expressing my museum research background, and he had just come from Argentina that they had had a very small but exhibition on UPA that he's promoting the documentary. So we started talking, and it's like, well, let's talk more, and that's sort of how it evolved, of like, I would like to be part of it. I was looking for opportunities, and it evolved from there.
That's amazing. You keep putting yourself so far out there and making your own opportunities. Like, you're not waiting for a specific job. You're just like, I like this. I want to do something with this. And then you do that thing with this. Oh my gosh. That's amazing. You can't top that now, so we have to end it there.
Okay. All right.
So where can everyone find you online?
Well, for Instagram, I'm at Animation Advocate. Twitter, I had to shorten that handle to Annie Advocate, A-N-I. And, of course, all the Disneylands on Instagram and all Disneylands on Twitter. And I will have a website eventually, but I'm not there yet. But if anyone wants to connect to me professionally, I do have a LinkedIn account and am open to people's outreach there.
Very nice. Well, thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. It helps us reach and share these stories with a wider audience. In sharing these female voices, we strive not only to help pave a path for aspiring women professionals, but to build a community and safe space for female creatives to support and empower one another. Like life, working in these industries is not a destination, but a journey of hopping from project to project. So I think we could all use the support. Wanna chat? We're on Twitter at Ink, the letter N, Paint Girls, on Facebook at Ink and Paint Girls Podcast, or email us at, guess what, inkandpaintgirlspodcast@gmail.com. The Ink and Paint Girls Podcast is brought to you by me, creator and host Cassie Soliday, and produced by Val Patrone in sunny Burbank, California. Music composed by TV Skyle. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Girls Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
All of the stuff you want to, like, save and share with the world and talk about and research, all burning. How do you feel about that?
Well, that was a leading question. I laughed and I loved it.